We have traveled to beautiful Beverly Hills, California, to talk with a man who was probably most responsible for making the most out of a non-visual area of radio by putting so many special pictures and programs on radio. His name is John Goodell, and we're happy to be out here to visit with you.
Thank you, Chuck. I'm happy you're here.
You were responsible for producing such mostly visual programs on radio as Truth or Consequences and People Are Funny.
No, Truth or Consequences was Ralph Edwards.
But you were involved in that.
Not in Ralph Edwards. We started our show. Matter of fact, it was called Pullover Neighbor. Mm-hmm. And it was on the coast, and it started on June 5th, 1938, here on the Pacific Coast on NBC. And Edwards' show started in 1940, coast to coast. Mm-hmm. So we started 2 years earlier, but he was on coast to coast before. And we didn't use the title People Are Funny until 1942. Matter of fact, I got into the visual radio business, as you mm-hmm. say, by accident. I was doing dramatic programs for Forest Lawn Memorial Park.
And cemetery.
Cemetery, uh-huh. yes, here in Southern California. And I did a lot of biographies, and I was in the library downtown looking up the name of Garfield. And by chance, out of context, the book next to Garfield was Games, G-A-M-E-S. I don't know what mm-hmm. it was doing in that section of the library. It wasn't supposed to be with biographies. And I pulled it out and looked at it, and there were parlor games. And I got to thinking, well, maybe there should be some parlor games on the radio, a little wilder than... At that time, there were only two people programs on the air, the mm-hmm. Vox Pop, which Wally Butterworth and Parks Johnson talked to people mm-hmm. at different factories, and they're just plain interviews, and Professor Quiz. And there were straight talk shows. So I was looking at these silly games, and I said, well, maybe this is the way radio should go. And on the very first program, which was called Pullover Neighbor, there's no reason for it to be called Pullover Neighbor, actually, except that I inherited a two-week-old quiz show about traffic safety in which there was a cop that says, pull over, neighbor, you know, with a motorcycle, and I will give you a traffic quiz, and if you pass, you get $12 uh-huh. or something uh-huh. like that. And I had inherited this because my boss quit and I took his job and I didn't want a straight quiz, and that's how I changed it. But I kept the title because these little pamphlets were printed by the gas company and were all around the state, so we had to keep the title, you see. And the very first so-called visual radio stunt was the very first night. It was a very high-class thing. We gave told a lady to sing the song Smiles, and at the end of each line, she was to put an ice cube in her mouth. Or we would force it in. And at the end, if you could still understand her, at the end of the song, she'd get $5.
Well, how many ice cubes could she get in her mouth?
She'd about six. It was I'm not sure. I think her mother was frightened by Martha Ray and had a rather large mouth. But anyway, that was the birth of of those wild stunt things. It was just that accident, maybe it was fortuitous, of finding the book in the wrong place in the library. And that Pullover Neighbor went on for 2 years. It was sponsored by an oil company, the Wilshire Oil Company here in Los Angeles and on the coast. And then it was canceled, and I sold it to Southern Pacific Railroad and called it All Aboard. And that went for 26 weeks. And then that was canceled. And on this show, the MC was not Art Linkletter. It was Art Baker.
Uh-huh.
Remember Art Baker?
Sure, he was on.
His name was Art Schenck then.
Art Schenck.
Yeah, Art Schenck was a song leader for Amy Semple McPherson, and the way we discovered him, he actually was the host of the dramatic Forest Lawn shows at the time we started this quiz show, and the reason he was the host of the dramatic Forest Lawn show is that he actually was the MC of the Last Supper window at Forest Lawn. What I mean is they have a beautiful window out there, you know, and there's all of the various uh-huh. fellows sitting there at that last dinner, you know,
And he was the MC.
People would come through there during the day, and he'd explain all about the window. And my boss, Clyde Scott, when we were looking for a host for this show, for a Forest Lawn program, a dramatic program, he said, well, why don't we use the fellow that's already working there? He's personable and so forth. And that started him on his career, you know, because you could also get him cheap. And he later changed his name to Art Baker because he went to work for General Mills and they wanted the thing for him with baking, you know. They thought that was kind of cute. That's the advertising agency mine.
It really works, though.
Yeah. And so Art Baker was the MC for Full Over Neighbor for 2.5 years. Then he was the MC for All Aboard for 6 months. And then the show was off the air and we couldn't sell it. But there was an advertising club luncheon, somewhere in 1940, I guess it was. And I was sitting down at the table at the Biltmore Hotel, and there were some pretty important executives around there, the president of the Richfield Oil Company and the head of a bank and so forth in one of the front tables. And I was looking at them, and they were all drawing pictures on the table, doodling, you know. One draws a sailor, and one draws stars, and one draws a tree. And the man on the stage was making a pretty dull speech, you know. He was, you know, was just talking there. And so I wrote down a comment about these, what was going on. I wrote, people are funny. Just the phrase, people are funny, as a comment. Then I put, I made it big, lots of letters and big, thick letters, you know, made it look like the 20th Century Fox, you know, the logo. And I thought, well, there's a theme for a program, human nature, proving that people are funny. So what happened was I thought I should have a psychologist on it, and do a stunt, and then have a psychologist analyze it. And I got a hold of a fella at USC named Milton Metfessel, who was a very high-class psychologist down there, a teacher. And we made a record. And this record we made with Art Linkletter. Now, that's where he comes into the picture. It's kind of interesting. I had a friend named Bruce Ells, and Bruce was a bank examiner, and Bruce said, can I get into radio? I don't like to be a bank examiner. And I said, I can get you a job, I think, with the head of Mutual as a salesman, which shouldn't be too hard. After all, salesmen are on commission. And he said, good. So I got him this job, and he became their very best salesman. That's Mutual on the coast. Mm-hmm. It was called Don Lee. It's a whole bunch of 30 stations on the coast. And he traveled a lot. And he came back from one of his trips, and he said, you know, last Sunday night in San Francisco, I was walking across the lobby of the Sir Francis Drake Hotel, and there's this young fella who was interviewing people on a program he called Who's Dancing Tonight, just standing there with a microphone talking to people. And I thought, he's awful good, and you ought to meet him. I think he's better than the fellow you have on, Art Baker, Art Shank. And I said, sure, what's his name? He said, Art Linkletter. And I said, well, the next time you run into him up there, because he's a guy traveling, tell him to, next time he's in Los Angeles, I'd like to have lunch with him. Mm-hmm. So he did set up such a lunch. And I met Art. He was standing by a lamppost out in front of the Melrose Grotto. And I introduced myself, and we went in and hit it off right away. And he had an idea for a psychology program called Meet Yourself. Mm-hmm. And I had People Are Funny. So we joined forces and made this record. Well, the record wasn't very good. It was all right, but it was kind of a serious record. So I patched it in and took some of the old Pullover Neighbor records, which were very funny, and interspersed them with the Linkletter People Are Funny record. And so it made it look like it had two MCs on it. We're back to Parks, Johnson, Wally Butterworth, you know. And it was pretty long. And I played it for NBC, and they owned a half interest in the record and in the show because they put up $15 for the record. And I put up $15, so they owned half interest. And they sent the record to New York, and the New York man named Clarence Menzer, who was head of programming at NBC at that time, he turned it down. He says, it's too dull. That psychologist is too dull. And so I said, well, can I buy back NBC's half interest for $15? They said, sure. So I gave him back the $15, and so I then owned the whole show. All I did was cut the psychologist out of the show and make it shorter. We just didn't have him anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a pretty good record then. And, you know, it didn't have a psychologist in it, and it was funny, and it had two MCs. And I took it to all three networks then. They all turned it down. I took it around to a lot of other places. About a year went by. And I read in the paper in March of 1942, that's right after the war started, the Daily Variety, Weekly Variety, had a front page story saying that the government gave the Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company 1 week to get a program off the air. Not even one more broadcast. They had to have no more broadcasts because it was called Captain Flag and Sergeant Quirk. And that's a funny show. And they did not, during wartime, want to show or depict Army officers fraternizing with enlisted men. Because that's what that did, Captain Flag.
That was based on the What Price Glory.
What Price Glory, yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. And they gave him 1 week. Well, I'd been writing letters to everybody, President Roosevelt and Cecil DeMille, you know, and trying to get something. And so I took this yellow sheet of paper and wrote, I have the answer to your problem, and sent it to the man's name of the agency, Russell, Tom Wallace, of the Russell Seeds Agency in Chicago, was mentioned in the article mm-hmm. as being involved. And I did feel I could afford to send a telegram because I sent out so many letters I saying, I have the answer to your problem, that I just sent letters, you know. And that's all it says, I have the answer to your problem. And if it, so apparently they did have a quick problem, so they sent a wire back, what is it, on Monday. And I sent them the record. And they got it on Wednesday. And they said, how much do you want for it? And I said, we want $5,000 a week. And they said, we'll offer you $750. And I said, well, is that your rock top? And we argued a bit and ended up at $750 for 4 weeks. And we went on 2 days later. You see, we had to go on that Friday. We didn't see any of the people back east. We didn't see the agency people. We didn't see the Brown and Williamson Tobacco Company people because the time was that they had live radio time coming up Friday
go,
at 6 o'clock on NBC, and what's going to fill it? So they had this high-class $750 program called The People Are Funny. And it was fair.
Well, did you do that now with
both,
one or two
both
MCs?
Both MCs. Huh. Well, after 2 weeks, Baker informed me that he said, I am not going to work with that other fellow, because that other fellow was a great ad-libber, and Baker wasn't. Baker was a nice fellow, but you'd have to write down on cards, yeah, that's what I would have said. And yes, sir, and thank you.
The whole business.
Yeah, he was a good voice and good newscaster, and a real nice guy, except that he didn't ad-lib. So he said, either he goes or I go. Now, Baker knew he had the strength because, after all, he was the one that was on the Coast shows that had the good ratings and everything. And Linkletter's that new fella from San Francisco that nobody had ever heard of. And the client said, take Baker, you know. We won't accept Linkletter, we'll accept Baker. So I talked to Art Linkletter, and I said, this guy's pulling a trick on us. He should have told us before it started, because he knew before it started. But he felt if he got it on the air, why, then he could make the deal.
Uh-huh. You know?
And so he did. So Linkletter agreed to go back to San Francisco and write jokes for the show and stuff. And I said, just bide your time. You'll get back on this show. And it took a year and a half. And the show bobbled along. It went pretty good. It was a fairly good, successful show. But after about a year and a half, I felt that it's just, if we could have a guy that could ad-lib, we'd be so much better. And here's Linkletter up in San Francisco. And so I fired Baker. And he sued me for $100,000. Well, he really didn't have a right to, as far as I was concerned, because he had never contributed. He didn't own part of the show. He was hired as an MC, and
did you have a contract with him?
The contract was as an MC.
Uh-huh.
He says, well, I know I can't win in the lawsuit, but I just want to make it tough, you know.
Well, did you fire him at the end of the contract or in the midst of it?
Oh, I could fire him any 13-week period.
Oh, I see.
And this was one of them.
Yeah.
I told the client that I was going to And then when he sued me, the client says, put him back, we don't want to be sued. Mm-hmm. But I said to the client, I said, well, I indemnify you anyway. The contract says, if you know, the packager indemnifies the network and the packager indemnifies the client, the mm-hmm. Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company. So I didn't have any money at all. We weren't making much money on this show. After all, we were making $7.50 in the beginning, and then it went up to $8.50 and then $1,000 and so forth. And matter of fact, on the very fourth week of the show of that original contract, we got a wire from the president of the agency. He said, this is the one that counts. And I wired back and I says, I'm glad you sent the wire because we weren't going to try tonight. Anyway, the lawsuit went on. Linkletter went on the show. Baker was off. And it started to pick up. Started to pick up right away. And then the lawsuit was a long-running thing, and it was $100,000. That's, you know, I had maybe $500 in the bank 1 month and maybe $250. Really mm-hmm. running low. And so I wouldn't know where it's going to come from. But a year later, and the thing was set to go to trial, jury trial. Baker's a nice white-haired guy and wonderful thing. I am not just John Goodell, a packager. I am National Broadcasting Company, Brown & Williamson Tobacco Company. There he lumps them all together because they're all defendants. Uh-huh. They don't realize that there's only one guy taking the rap for these other two because of the indemnification clause. Well, I sold a show to Pepsodent called The Charlotte Greenwood Show, and we were on our way to New York to set it up, and it was the summer of 44. And Art had gone on the show the previous October, so the suit was now about 9 or 10 months along, was ready to go to trial. And just casually, as we were going along about Cleveland, the lawyer for the Charlotte Greenwood people, the Footcone & Belly Advertising Agency, said, how you coming with that lawsuit Art Baker has against you? And I said, well, we're going to trial in next week. He said, well, he can't sue you. I says, he can't. I says, no. He says, an actor cannot sue the producer without first going to arbitration. Says so on page 7 after code book so-and-so. Now, this Martin Gang is a show business lawyer. I'd made the mistake of getting a downtown lawyer, you know, a friend of the family, that sort of thing. He didn't know about the after thing. So I got off the train, and I wired my lawyer. He says, look it up, page so-and-so. And so we did go to arbitration. And we won.
Did you send your lawyer a fee then on that?
Our lawyer, the lawyer on the train, uh-huh. was my arbitrator. Uh-huh. And then Baker had his arbitrator, and then there was a neutral arbitrator. Baker's arbitrator was a judge, Leroy Dawson, a very fine fellow, whom we immediately used on the program several times because mm-hmm. he was so funny. And a real good guy. But at any rate, that was an incident there. And Baker and I became somewhat friends after that. He's passed away, I presume.
Yes, he was on the television
you asked for. Yeah.
No,
mm-hmm.
you didn't have anything to do with that.
No, I didn't have anything to do with anything he had to do with after this particular situation.
Well, then Art Linkletter came on the scene and he ran away with it, didn't he?
Art Linkletter ran away with it, yes. It really picked up, and that was in the fall of 43 when Art went on, and that show went on 19 years. The radio went from 1942 until 1954, 12 years, and then the television from 54 to 61.
Mostly on radio, it was Raleigh Cigarettes, wasn't it? Or the tobacco company.
Yes, it was Raleigh and Cool, and yes. Uh-huh. And then it was Milky Way candy bars mm-hmm. and the Manna freezers and that sort of thing. It's odd, you were speaking of the visual things, why you do certain visual things. We were going to do a show at the Long Beach Municipal Auditorium, and we called for a cow to be on the program. And Irvin Atkins, who was the guy that did everything on the show, mm-hmm. you know, you go get anything you want, he went to the maintenance man at the auditorium and says, this elevator's strong enough to hold a cow. And he says, it's strong enough to hold an elephant. services told me the story. I said, well, let's get an elephant instead. So that's how we happened to have an elephant on instead of a cow. And it's amazing how this picked up around the country. He says, they put an elephant on the radio because there's something about it. When the audience saw him, when the contestants saw him, it went through their voices and things.
Now, this was probably a rather small elephant.
As big as his room.
The elephant was?
Sure. Full-size elephant.
Oh, all right.
Now, if we can get a full-size elephant for the same price as a little elephant, we're going to get a full-size
Well,
elephant.
I was wondering, you see, the listener at home, you know, his imagination is working. You're saying, here's an elephant.
Oh.
And he's saying it could be as big an elephant as he wanted it to be. See, but you didn't really have to have it. But because of the studio audience, you wanted to get that reaction.
Well, if you're going to go that far down, you could go down to a little Pekingese and say, this is an elephant. The audience would just laugh, you know, and everything. Yeah. But no, actually, we tried to make it as... the imagination helped an awful lot. Because there's a funny thing. You know, we do those outside stunts where you send somebody out and then bring them back. And the reason, one of the reasons the network people turned that show down originally is they said, you mean you give a man outside to do something and you never cut outside with a tape machine or, I mean, with a record or listen to it and you never do anything till he comes back? And I said, did you just hear what happened? He says, that's right. He says, that won't work. You've got to hear him while you're outside. Well, I said, no, that won't work, because first place, it interrupts what you're doing on stage. Mm-hmm. The second place, actually, it's not very good. The imagination and how they tell it of what really happened is concise at the end, whereas if it had been picked up here and there, you know, there's nothing so dull as an open mic on a street before anything is edited.
Yeah.
They says, now we'll go back to them in a few minutes, you know.
Well, it used to be fun, though, because he'd cut away, he'd send them out, and say goodbye to him, audience. Isn't that what the art used to say? And then you'd almost forget about him, except maybe some words,
you might
announcer
refer
or somebody
to him,
might make a mention of it. And then when they'd come back, you know, you'd be really excited about hearing what they were saying.
Yeah.
And if someone outside who was participating in the stunt, and they bring them back, and then they tell about their reaction. It really was.
Yes, when you bring an extra person back that was they found out there, that helped a lot. That helped a lot,
I often had a guy in a bed at the corner of Hollywood and Vine or sleeping out there or waving a car that would growl at people or something like that. It's fantastic. Who thought up all of the stunts?
Oh, we had, I was principally a writer. Because I used to write Laurel and Hardy comedies.
You did?
Oh, yeah. And Our Gang. And that's what I did before I got into radio. I got fired six times from Hal Roach Studios. Every time Mr. Roach would want to go to Alaska to hunt bear, pretty chilly up there, he would close the studio. And so we'd all get fired. The writers would get fired. And then we'd come back, and he'd come back and open studio. Work again, you know. And so fired six times in 3.5 years of this radio came along. I thought that would be a good idea, you know.
How would you write? I have to step aside from this for a moment. How did you write the material for Laurel and Hardy? I mean, did you give them an outline and they just took it away?
They had a script, sort of, and a storyline and a dialogue. It looked something like a script. There was an awful lot of work done on the set. And Laurel was brilliant, and he did a lot of improvisation, and you just kind of help out after they're on the set. The writing that was done more followed directly was for the Charlie Chase, the Thelma Todd, and Patsy Kelly comedies, the R Gang. And the R Gangs were tough to do because, you know, they always did everything as a group. The gang thinks some way. Now, you know, that's seven kids doing the same thing. They go in and out of a door all together. It's awkward, and it looked awkward. But the things were fairly successful.
You worked only on the comedies, and I mean the shorts, not...
No, I worked on the Bohemian Girl feature and General Spanky, which did 65% of normal business that year. You know, Photoplay would list all of the shows, all the movies. San Francisco was at the top in 1936, and there was about seven columns, and we were second from the bottom with General Spanky. We beat out Jack Haley and Mexican Hayride. I think he did 62% of
all. Be glad to be reminded of that.
Yeah, yes. Well, at any rate, your original question about people are funny. Jack Stanley, who recently passed away, this fellow I knew at UCLA, and he was just crazy. You know, he'd wear a coonskin cap with a thing hanging down the front, and he'd go to all of UCLA football games. He'd have a trumpet and yell charge. That kind of a fella. Uh-huh. He later became a writer, and as you could and on People Are Funny. And then there was, who else? Lou Shore was a writer, wasn't he, on People Are Funny? My father. Really? Oh, yes, I'd hired him, and he was a writer and sort of a production man for years, and he was still on the show when it went off, and he was 75 years old then.
Oh, great.
Well, on the House Party show, yes.
We're getting some aside help from Mrs. Yes. Goodell.
Yeah, why don't you come over here, honey, and you can help me out here with some of this stuff. Come on over here.
We're chatting in the Goodell living room here.
Yeah, Mrs. Goodell is was cut in half by Blackstone for 8 years on the road.
He hasn't suffered a bit by it either. You were also a contestant on Groucho Marx's program.
Yes, I was.
Yeah, that was before the infamous sawing in half.
Right, about 2 years before.
Oh, good. Well, she suffered. She looks pretty good today.
Yes, the Band-Aids don't show.
Well, we bring up You Bet Your Life because you produced that program.
Yes, that came about rather interestingly, I thought. That overlapped People Are Funny, as well as the House Party overlapped them both, you know. I think the entrance, how shows start, are of interest. I think, for example, how House Party started was of interest. Because a lot of people listening to the radio say, well, how can I get into these things? Mm-hmm. And how do these things happen? I told you how the chance of People Are Funny reading it in the paper. Didn't need an agent. You just be alert to what's going on. Right time.
Now, let's set the scene for a second. The House Party was, Art Linkletter was the host of that. And that was a daily show.
Every day,
in
yes.
In the afternoon,
yes.
Usually?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Yes. Audience
it,
participation.
Yes, it ran 26 years and was one of the top three programs longer than any other daytime program. So it was had a highly successful rate. It was on CBS most of the time. It was on ABC a while.
How did it get started?
Well, I had sold a show to International Silver through Young and Rubicam called The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet in the summertime of the year 44. And I went to New York, and it was around noon. I went up to Young and Rubicam, which is the advertising agency, and to meet the fellas that had bought the show over the phone. You know, I'd sent them a record, and, you know, we got back and forth. And they was empty, except for one fellow named Stanley Joseloff that was sitting there. And I said, where is everybody? He said, they're all out to lunch. I said, well, you must be buying something. He says, no, we're very happy. Everything's fine. We're not interested in any kind of programs of any kind. I says, what's that note on your desk, which I was reading upside down? Dick Powell audition, 10:30. He says, you read that upside down? I says, yeah. He says, well, that's all set. And I says, what do you mean? He says, well, tomorrow morning, Dick Powell is auditioning a musical show for General Electric, and the time's already bought, and it's all set to go on January 15th. And this was, well, I guess this must have been about September, October at the time. And I said, it's all set, but they haven't actually bought it. And he says, no, they haven't bought it, but they're tomorrow morning at 10:30, they're going to buy it. He says, if I come to you for something you like better between now and not tomorrow morning at 10:30, will you, is it eligible? He says, oh, sure. You know, we're all set, Dick Powell, big star and everything. So I said, okay, I'll be back. And so I went back to the hotel, and I called Linkletter in San Francisco. Now, he was commuting to do People Are Funny every week. I said, would you like to come and live in Los Angeles? He said, sure. Why? I said, well, we've got this maybe 5-day-a-week show for General Electric. And he said, well, what'll we do? And I said, well, I don't know, we'll figure out something, you know, some daytime show. And I had wanted to do Kids. And actually, I stole the idea from Quiz Kids in this fashion. Quiz Kids were on the radio, and once a week at night. And I said out loud one time, he said, you know, it seems to me that if the public could identify with ordinary kids, they would like them as well or better than with these real brilliant kids. It'd be, hey, that in other words, a kid just like their own on the radio in preference to a brilliant kid, you know. And so Art liked that idea, and we'd been kicking that around. And we made a record of it called Paging Young America, designed for nighttime ordinary kids, Art Linkletter. And so I said, I got to use that somehow. But, of course, you can't have 5 half-hours of kids because they have to go to school. So what I did is I went and made a calendar and put the kids 5 minutes each day and then filled out the rest from stuff out of the woman's books. We'll have a hairstylist. We'll have a homemaker thing. We'll have so forth. And the thing that sold it to General Electric was that we'll pretend we're in a different room of the house, and we'll call it open house. And when we are in the kitchen, we'll talk about your kitchen appliances. And when we're on the bedroom, they have some bedroom appliances. Mm-hmm. And in the living room, they'd have the radio and the things.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And they thought that was clever, you know, just one thing like that from a commercial point of view. Because we're not anywhere. It's your radio imagination, you know. And we'd have sets built, we'd say, and have them, and so they'd walk around and hit the things. And at any rate, Linkletter was doing well on People Are Funny, so they liked the MC. And they didn't buy us, but they didn't buy Dick Powell.
Dick Powell. Yeah.
See? And they paid for an audition, and we made one, and we went on the air. And, in other words, if you're in there at the last minute, and, of course, our price was better, too. Well, you know, we didn't.
Well, you see, the big thing though was the
timing.
Well, yeah, but going to the heart of it with the sponsors. This is how we're going to pitch your product.
Yes, yes, and they thought that was good because instead of just stopping something, I said we'll mingle it in. Mm-hmm. You know, and of course there was one interesting thing that one fella, I think, I don't know whether he got fired or not, but they were going to introduce a coffee maker. And they took us on tour for 19 weeks. But this one particular week, they're going to introduce the coffee maker. They chose Salt Lake City. And we were going to give coffee makers to every contestant. And all this big thing and all the coffee makers. And the very first contestant says, here's your coffee maker. Says, I'm a Mormon. I don't drink coffee. Thank you very much. Every person in that audience was a Mormon. Every person in that audience all week long was a Mormon. This is the only major city in the United States we could have picked where they don't drink coffee as our coffee maker launcher. Isn't that something?
Well,
you were back to... back to the Groucho thing.
Oh, well, we're just jumping around.
Yeah,
that's all right.
I see.
Now, House Party did, of course, make a very easy transition to television, too.
Oh, yes, yes. And, House Party went on radio in 45, and it went on radio until, it overlapped television by some 15 years. We had both on simulcast.
Yeah.
And I guess radio went from 45 to about 65, and television went from... 52 to 70. So the run was 26 years.
Did GE start it on television too?
No.
Did they sponsor?
No, GE started on radio, mm-hmm. and they had a strike shortly after we went on, and we lost them as a sponsor, and then we were on co-op for a while with McMahon Furniture and some others, and then we really got Pillsbury. Pillsbury was mm-hmm. the key sponsor of the radio yeah. show. And that was an interesting sale. I had heard on the street on Vine Street, just happened to meet a fella, and I said, you know, House Party isn't sponsored. And he says, well, why don't you talk to Bill Waddell? He can sell anything. It was a Leo Burnett agency in Chicago, mm-hmm. and he was the head of their radio. And I said, well, I'm going to Europe, and I'm going through Chicago on Sunday, and I'll see if I can call him. And he said, well, there's a possibility they're looking around for something for Pillsbury. They're going to buy K. Kaiser.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, okay. And so I got off the train at one station when you get through with the super chief and called Waddell. And there's only 5 Waddells in the Chicago phone book. And one of them looked like he'd be an ad agency man because it said Hillsdale. And, you know, it sounds like where an ad agency man would live. And the other looked, you know, it said Cicero and 14th Street and other things. And I didn't feel an ad agency man would live there. So I called the Hillsdale number, which was it was 40 cents.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't answer. So I went over to the other station. Now, this is how on what's a fine line a sale can be made or lost. Went over to the other station, which was the train to go to New York, and called again just before the train left. and let it ring and ring and ring and said, operator, give me my money back. He said, wait a minute, here's your party. And it was Bill Waddell. And I introduced myself and said, and here again, they were just about to buy something. He said, well, we're going to Minneapolis to sign up the Kay Kaiser show for Pillsbury on Tuesday. And can you make us a definite offer on this thing? Sounds good. I'd like to talk about it. I said, well, General Foods has a, Young Rubicam has an option for 90 days. He said, well, that's out. I said, however, Pat Weaver's a nice fella, and when I'm in New York tomorrow, I'll try to get him to lift it. Then you can make the offer. And so he said, fine. And, you know, Weaver said next day, he was head of Young and Rubicam Radio. And he said, we got 90 days, huh? And I says, yeah. And he says, well, I only got two clients, Borden and General Foods. He says, I'll call them both up now. He says, you don't want to buy that show, do you? And he says, no. He says, Nicole, he says, you know, you have to buy it right now or else or something. You know, he just kind of fuddled with the executives, and they weren't really interested. He says, okay, 90 days is off. Go ahead. Isn't that nice of him?
Super, yeah.
Yeah, you know, they could have held on and fussed around and made presentations, but they didn't have any real prospects. Those were their two big people in that. And so I called Bill Waddell, and we'd talk every once in a while. I went to Europe, and we talked from Scotland and talked from Germany and talked, and finally in Switzerland, the deal was all set. And Link was in Rome, so I called him. It was very, very international in that thing. And Pillsbury, you know, they bought the whole show, and they were wonderful, wonderful outfit. They were with us all the way through radio and television until it was off. They didn't have the whole show in television. Nobody buys the whole show in television. No. The last thing is the Groucho thing, and you're running out of your time here, I see. You got about 5 minutes. Started in an interesting way.
Ever the producer.
Well, there was a Walgreen two-hour radio show on once a year for a penny sale, and they got a lot of people that were stars. A radio spectacular, I guess you'd call it. And Linkletter was called to do a People Are Funny stunt, and I was the producer, and so I was there, and I held the needle, which was to hand to Linkletter, which was to hand to Cesar Romero, who was blindfolded, who was supposed to put a patch on the seat of a contestant's pants. It was a very high-class stunt. But I was sitting there in the audience watching Bob Hope and Groucho Marx reading a script, funny stuff. And Bob dropped his script by accident. So Groucho dropped his script on purpose. And they were much, much funnier with their scripts dropped than they were reading the stuff. And afterwards, I went up to Groucho, whom I didn't know, and said, you know, hiring you to read a script is like buying a Cadillac for the purpose of hauling coal. You don't utilize your abilities. And he'd flopped four times on the radio. And I said, you want to do a quiz show? He says, you mean compete with refrigerators? And I said, yeah. He says, well, I've flopped four times so far. What can I lose? And that's how we went in business together to do this particular show, which was a rebirth for him because he was 57 years old then. And we made that show for $250 and the radio record. And I took it to all the networks. They all turned it down. And because they said Groucho's flopped four times on the radio. So then I read in the paper, here's the reading the variety again, that Alan Gelman, president of Elgin American Compact Company of Chicago, is coming to the Beverly Hills Hotel to sign up Phil Baker for his new quiz show, Everybody Wins. So he's going to, see? So I called up Mr. Gelman at the Beverly Hills. I said, have you signed up Phil Baker yet? He says, no. I said, I want you to hear a record. So I took the record up to his room and played it. And he didn't know Groucho had flopped four times on the radio. He says, this is a funny record. I remember him in the Coconuts. There's a pretty funny man, you know. Okay. And we made the deal. And Phil Baker fired his press agent. Anyway, that's how the thing got on.
You aced him out every time, didn't you?
Well, I mean, not every time. I'm telling you about the successes. You want to talk about the failures.
What was your most spectacular failure?
I think the Jackie Coogan show was. Because it was on 13 weeks, but they changed agencies before it went on, and it was canceled before it went on. In other words, the McCann agency bought it, and then they had a party for the Broma Seltzer people to come up to New York, and Jackie Coogan didn't get to the party, and it was for him. And so they changed agencies anyway to BBDO, and BBDO canceled the show at the request of the Emerson Drug Company before it went on. So here we go on with 13 weeks with a show that was already canceled. And if it had been a big smash, it would have helped. But it doesn't help the morale of the actors say, all right, we're going into a show that's canceled.
Yeah, so it's over before we start.
And it started in April, and it was 8 o'clock on Monday night, and there was too much daylight. And anyway, it wasn't very good. It wasn't bad. It was a comedy show, a half hour of Jackie Coogan in a drugstore talking in a high voice forever. And Loreen Tuttle was good on it. She played a little girl. And it wasn't bad compared to situation comedies, but it was a spectacular failure, I would say.
Well, your
The Lids Off wasn't very good either, with Art Linkletter. But that was 10:30 at night, and the title said we were going to be real X-rated. Well, Art isn't a very X-rated guy, you know, and the publicity department of ABC took off, the lid's off, you know. And the lid was on, that's right.
Well, your successes far outnumber your failures. And
well, at least I talk about
Groucho. The Groucho thing was on radio first for a couple of years before it went
3 years. TV. 3 years on radio and then 11 on television.
Yeah. Did it go into television with Elgin American or right away with the...
Oh, no. Elgin American was only on... They'd go on for 26 weeks and then try to get out for the... See, they only had Christmas selling.
Oh, I see.
And we just fussed along with them. And they were nice people because they started us. But it was DeSoto, Chrysler Plymouth, that really took over there. Yeah. And they kept it for a long while, and we ran DeSoto out of business. In other words, you know, they didn't made it an extinct car by having so many people. Actually, it wasn't the right product. Here we had a very large mass audience, a number one, number two show in radio and television, and a $6,000 item. So we figured Tony and Lever Brothers and those people, those are the ones that could use it, and those are the ones that finally got it.
And we're getting it again because we have the best of Groucho all over the place.
You got it in Chicago, and it's in a lot of other stations, and it's got a lot of young people, never saw Groucho before, are interested in that, which is interesting because he's Lemon, you know. He's bitter on the outside and bitter on the inside,
but everybody
he's
loves
a balloon
the
pricker.
Marx Brothers movies and enjoying him on television.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
really right. Yeah. You've done a great job with your career over all these years, and I think you've had a good time with it too, haven't you?
Oh, I think it's been a lot of fun. It's certainly been a lot of fun, and I'm still trying.
What you going to do next?
Try to get out of the electronic business.
Yeah, you've got a nice little business on the side that you're
trying to
get out of.
Yeah, nice little. Yeah,
I don't want to hear about it.
I have to go back into television to make up the losses in the electronic. I have advice to all you listeners, if you're still with us, stay with what you know.
Well, all right, let's stay with what you know. Well, could you do an audience participation show on radio today? Would you like to do one?
Oh, I think people could. It? Yeah, sure. I think people could do that because radio is basically talk. And if you have, if your units are short enough, you see, radio apparently works in a much shorter memory span than it used to. Everything's got to be little units that you can catch in the car. And have you ever noticed that? They don't seem to have very long things on radio. I mean,
some places we try to take a little more time because our chat here is going to play intact without being broken.
Oh, well, that's so nice. That's 40 minutes.
That's right.
Good. Well, thank you, Chuck.
John Goodell, thanks very much. We appreciate being with you today.
All right, thank you.